Welcome back, folks, to another episode of The Entrepreneur Circle. I am your most happy and humbled host, Eric Cabral. As usual, I have a close and personal friend of mine who is going to share some time with me and also share some wisdom with you based off his life, his experience, his business, his family, all the things. But first, before we get into the show, I want to welcome my bro from another mother, Matt Kavanaugh. What's up, bro?
What's going on, man? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's a long time coming. You and I are in multiple things together, not just GoBundance, but we have our own little tribe and our own little meetings outside of GoBundance, which is great. And I get to share some time and spend some time and learn a ton from you. But for those who don't know who Matt Kavanaugh is, he's the founder of the Freedom Chasers podcast, which I highly go recommend you check out. It inspires real estate agents and working pros to leave their day jobs for greater freedom and for greater purpose. So he was previously a top performing sales pro in the B2B space, as well as a high school math teacher. And as a thought leader, he shares his experience in that show about investing, lifestyle design, all things real estate. And he helps people all across the country, coaching his agents, coaching his community on how to achieve financial freedom through real estate, mindset, sales. He's helping me big time with and more. So we're going to get into you and your story, brother. But again, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, bro, let's get into the first question that I really hold dear, which is the eureka moment in your life or business that caused a major change or pivot.
So for me, it was just kind of recognizing that energy is not like linear. So for example, like a lot of people go through life and they fight having enough energy to do what they need to do. And I started to just have these observations that like in certain settings, I had low energy. In certain settings, I had a lot of high energy. So like if I was on a sales call or a negotiation or something like that, my energy was really, really high and I was feeling alive and excitable. But I would walk across the street and have a conversation with somebody that maybe I had a negative interaction with and my energy would drop to like zero. And I think as I kind of carried on with that thought experiment of why do I have unlimited energy in some cases and almost no energy in others, you know, I started to test things and like, how do I maximize energy? So how can I work a 12 or 13 hour day and have as much energy at the end of the day as I do at the beginning? And so that for me was a eureka moment, is that energy is not, you don't use it equally across your day. And so as I started to put more of my day into what gave me energy, I was able to get so much more accomplished, have so much more passion, and I would consider it to be freedom, doing the things that are most natural.
Is this a somewhat recent revelation?
So I think it kind of goes in phases, right? So I think there was like, you kind of like naturally go, well, I don't like doing this, so I'll go to this over here. But I think like a hyper-focused realization probably in the last like 4 or 5 years. And so then all the way down to like, you know, us being in a pod together, you know, like I can go all in on things, right? So it's like, okay, well now instead of doing one podcast a week, I'll do 10 or 30. And so it's like when I find something now that I like, instead of like increasing it by 5%, I just like overdose on it, you know, because of how much energy it brings.
Do you ever find that you have a propensity to, you know, when you go all in, burn the candle on both ends? Do you ever feel burnout or what are some of the signs, red flags for you? Like, okay, I need to slow down.
So burnout, I think, is an interesting thing. I think you can burn out from working too much, but I don't think burnout is only correlated to working too much. I think it's correlated to the way that you perceive the things that you're doing. And so if you're doing things that you really love, I think burnout is a lot harder to come by. And I also think burnout is countered by purpose. So if there's a mission and a purpose, I think burnout is a lot, it's not going to come as easily. Like if you're doing things for the money, and they're not exactly aligned with things that bring you energy, I think burnout comes pretty quickly, maybe in 6 months or a year or 18 months. But I think when you combine a true passion and a purpose, like a mission behind who you're serving, then I think you can go really hard for a very long time before you'd experience burnout.
I love that, dude. Who's the branding guy here, man? You're speaking really, my language, dude, and highlighting some things that I don't think I've heard many people say. It's a great perspective to look at burnout in terms of okay, how long can I go? It's kind of like, running a marathon. You know, if your drive and passion to get to the end goal is this massive thing, I'm sure people want to tie it into their identity, or they have a personal thing that they want to get over, whatever it is, it helps you. And then you're kind of physically burning the candle on both ends, because I don't know how long it takes for people to recover when they do like triathlons and things like that. But I love that. If you have purpose, then it kind of mitigates or allows you and gives you more runway to expand and keep working. So I want to get into some of the things that I know you're really good at. I know you too well, where I'm like, I could be all over the place and people won't have context. But when we first met, years ago, you were looking into brand, and I think I was one of the ones that was trying to convince you need brand, and you had accomplished a lot without it. Can you talk a little bit about your mindset then versus your mindset now, and then also like how did you accomplish so much without really having a brand? I just want to, because that's the opposite of most people who listen to the show. They're like, it's all about branding, but for you, you did it, and now you're on to the next level. Yeah.
So I think this is where we could talk about the differentiation between sales and marketing. I feel like I was very, very good at sales and you're very good at marketing. And I think brand is kind of associated, marketing comes out of brand. And so I was very good at helping people identify their problems and do that fairly clearly in a one-to-one interaction. Like if I'm on a phone call or in person with somebody, it was very natural for me to be able to ask them the questions that kind of opened them up. I gained a lot of that experience from being a youth pastor and being, in a situation where we had to open people up so that they would share the things so we could help them with their problems. And then my level of energy, intensity, and curiosity is kind of does the other part of the work of like, no, I'm not giving up until we get to the bottom of things. So I think a combination of those two things allowed me to understand what people's problems are. Once you understand a person's problems and the pain they're experiencing with that, solving that and them wanting to use you becomes very natural, hence the sales. And so that's what allowed us to get to multiple six figures, seven figures of sales in a few different industries, was the ability to get down to the bottom with people very quickly. And so for me, that was a phone call or a door knock or an open house or whatever the method was, meeting somebody and going from 0 to 60 with them. Like I just met with somebody here in the studio last week, and I had her telling me her financials, her net income, her visions within 15 minutes of meeting me. And so that's a gift that I've, a skill that I've honed. But branding to me, it always seems so hard. It was like, okay, well, do I just need to wear a suit? It was like always a visual thing. And it was hard. I also think being a person that's so curious and liking to be in different ideas, the idea of having one singular way of thinking about myself was also like, I couldn't possibly fathom how I could do that. So, but clearly watching you, and seeing you walk in a room and be instantly recognized, and to see that people would refer you because they knew exactly how you did, what you did, why you did it, was like, okay, I really do need this.
Yeah, that's kind of the, I guess, the coming to light when you realize that, there is something to it that's helpful, right? And so you kind of started to see, I guess, the results of having that type of thing. But I really appreciate the sales side of things where if you can marry the two, like brand and sales or marketing and sales, where you could be really good at both. And I love your approach to sales. You know, I've experienced it firsthand where, like you said, you really get to the root of the human issue and what they are looking for. Maybe they are looking for something specific, but just listening to their words, you're able to identify some other issues that maybe it may be wrapped in that they're not even aware of. I feel like you have that beautiful mind and that you kind of see the zeros and ones when people are talking. You're able to kind of deconstruct like, okay, hey, you're saying this, but I think you might also need this. Have you thought about this? Which is great. And one of those tools, and I want to get into tools on sort of how you approach things, because I know you just have this inherent ability. But for those who don't, you use tools like the Enneagram and other tools like that. Can you speak a bit? I know you're really kind of the expert when it comes to that stuff. You want to sort of explore and expand on that a bit?
Yeah. So the Enneagram specifically, and there's a lot of tools that I've kind of added to my arsenal as a part of how I approach a situation. But the Enneagram specifically breaks into someone's core motivations. So the general premise is that people have one of maybe nine core motivations. Either they strive for perfection, or they strive for achievement, or they strive for love within the context of relationships. Those become their defining virtue. And as a result of that being the one thing they want the most, there's strengths that they gain and there's weaknesses and blind spots that they possess. And there's a certain level of comfort that they have with certain things and a level of absolute not going to happen that they have. And so understanding that and then being like, I put in a lot of reps, tens of thousands of reps, thinking through what people could be and how that impacts them. Then you kind of know, if I speak this way with this person, I'm going to be completely out of context with their language and how they want to be speaking and what's valuable to them. But if I speak this way, we're going to be in sync. And so you can use that to manipulate people, or you can use it just to like be loving to them, right? To speak in ways that, and it doesn't make me perfect by any means. Sometimes I'm wrong. But more importantly, sometimes it's just like, it takes, you know, effort, right? To care enough about somebody to deliver that, you know, to think about it in their terms, not in the way that you want to think, but in the way that they think. And so when I'm on my game and, you know, pursuing it, it just allows you to get into the issues. It allows you to unpack and open people up in minutes instead of hours or years.
Yeah, I love that. You reminded me of a quote you said to me once. I don't know if you could remember, but I was asking you specifically what you just said here, where some people may see sales or using tools like the Enneagram as a, you know, it's manipulation. Like you're kind of, they feel very vulnerable when because they don't know the questions that you're asking, or, you know, they know the questions you're asking are leading to a certain result. Can you talk about that? Do you remember what you said to me? You're like, it's not manipulation if this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So basically, like the way that I like to think about it is, you could choose whether or not you want to speak someone's language. Let's say, you know, you speak Spanish and I speak English. Like, I could speak to you in English and say, it's not natural for me to speak to you in Spanish because that's not my natural language. Right. But that wouldn't make any sense. Now we're not going to communicate on a high level. Right. So I view it as, by learning someone's language, you're showing love to them because you can communicate. Now, once you speak to them, you've seen this in business, right? Well, you just learned Spanish because now they're going to buy from you, right? Automatically. And it's like, well, that is one of the byproducts. But I think manipulation all comes down to one thing. Do you have their best interest at heart, or do you have your own best interest at heart? And so for me, learning someone's language is an act of love. And then continuing to show more value to them by protecting their best interests, knowing that they're going to be more receptive to what you have to offer because of the work you put in to understand the way they speak.
I love that. Do you think it comes from, because you've mentioned love probably almost half a dozen times, over the past few minutes. Would you say that, you know, manipulation, it's not manipulation if you have their best interest at heart? You know, that always stuck in my mind. And I know a lot of people who are listening to this probably struggle with, most people struggle with sales, and because they feel like they're doing something, manipulating, whatever it is. But I love that. Like, did that come from or stem from your youth pastor, your faith, your family? Like, where did that come from? Because that rings true, you know, when people get in the room and speak with you.
I feel like I have who I was born as, and then like nature versus nurture, right? So my nature is a highly analytical, very fast, intuitive strategist. Like, that's how I was born. Like, I was born to be at the poker tables in Vegas, right? But then I was born into a family where my parents were, you know, very, especially my dad, was very, very attuned to his faith. So I was going to Bible studies and conferences and things. And so in the Christian world, it was all about loving people and being kind and, you know, caring about people. And money, especially in Christianity, is generally viewed as a negative thing, right? Or at least neutral at best. And so you have that kind of DNA built in. So I think philosophically, it caused me to want to care more about people. But I can't take away this mental engine that I have running. And so it's really like, both are at play there. Now, the youth pastor side allowed me to really understand through training that, like, you sit with people, right? You listen to them. Oftentimes when people are speaking, they don't recognize they're not saying the truth. They're not trying to lie to you, but they think things are a certain way. They're just not, right? They're not self-aware enough, or they're not aware of the situation, or a number of things. And so you learn to listen for the things that are not said. You learn to listen for the inconsistencies. And you kindly, after a lot of listening, kind of point out like, hey, you know, I noticed between this and this, to try and get down to the truth. So really, it was skills built in the, quote, counseling, not that I was a professional counselor, but in those types of settings, plus the philosophy, plus my natural, you know, mind that kind of put this all together.
Love that. When did you realize you had a natural ability to get into sales? Like, did that start at a young age?
No. I mean, I'd say some might say that because, like, I'm persistent. And so that's obviously generally a negative but true stereotype of salespeople is that they're persistent. But I think, like, I left teaching because I wasn't making enough money. Like, we were choosing between running the air conditioning at our house and eating a Little Caesar's pizza for that matter. That was the financial decisions we had to make. So for me, I needed to make more income to provide for my family. And so sales was obviously one of the easiest and most lucrative jobs you can get. So I was like, well, let me just go do the opposite of teaching, right? Let me just go make some money for a second. And I was in a position where I was the sole provider for our family. So if I wasn't successful, you know, we're bankrupt. So there was a lot of motivation there. And so that was like the propeller, so to speak. But what I recognized very quickly, studying some of the best salespeople in the world, is it was just helping people. It was just a relentlessness of understanding what their problems were and saying, like, if I truly had the solutions our company did, just offering that to them. So once I recognized sales was not some sleazy endeavor, or it didn't have to be, then it was like, okay, yeah, I could be really, really good at this. But this was like in 2011. So this was just like 12 years ago, 13 years ago.
Yeah. How did you get over the hurdle, that most people have when it comes to sales? Because I know you had the pressures of providing for the family, but what were you selling? You know, what was sort of the first things that you got into?
Yeah. So for 3.5 years, I sold for a industrial services company. So I sold business to business, or in other words, B2B. And so this was, people would have these large food processing plants and these big companies, and we would sell, basically laundry service. So the company would deliver uniforms and these other things and would, and so Brian, who's also in GoBundance, sold for one of our competitors. So we kind of talk about that and joke about that every now and then. So really it was, I wasn't selling to, people on the streets or anything, right? It was to companies who were already using a competitor service. So that part was a little easier in the sense that I'm not convincing them to buy, blueberries in an MLM, right? I was convincing businesses to just switch to us. Mm. It didn't make it an easier thing to sell, but I didn't feel bad. Like, I wasn't trying to force somebody to buy something that they didn't need. It was really just more about overcoming rejection and figuring out how do I pitch this to make the sale work.
Yeah. And then how long were you able to do that before you started to kind of hone in on that and develop it and make it bigger?
So because I felt like my life depended on that success, because, for me, especially at that age, I was like, dude, like, I'm the only breadwinner. So like everything rides on me. What I did was during the business hours, because in B2B sales, you can only sell from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday because businesses shut down after that. So what I said is, okay, I'm going from 8 to 5. That's my prospecting time. Anything after that is when I'll do my paperwork and contracts and things of that nature. So I was like, I willingly signed myself up to work 60 to 80 hours a week. And it's like, I'm going to do this until I know I'm set. So from 8 to 5, I would hit the phones, hit the doors, that kind of thing. So that was one of the biggest things, was just putting in way more reps than anybody else until I knew. So it took me about 6 months to where I was like, okay, I'm not going to lose my job. This is going to work. And by 1 year, I was in the top, tier of the national sales reps.
Mm, it's like the Kobe method, right? Like just constantly in the gym and getting there earlier than everyone. Most people just don't want to do it, right? Do what you did. And I see you doing it in the podcasting space. You know, you got into it, and once you decided you were all in, you were all in. And, 8, 10 episodes a day. I mean, that's bananas to me. But yeah, you're putting in the reps just like you normally do. Can you speak to, I know you like to inspire, people in your community, especially real estate agents or W-2s for that matter, to achieve financial freedom. Can you share how you do that and what you guys usually discuss on your calls?
Yeah. So let's say we're coaching an agent. The biggest thing that I found when I built my real estate agent business is I built it to what was normal. Like there was a prescribed path that most coaches and people talk about how you build your team. What I recognized is that path didn't work for me. It didn't work for my personality. And so I grew a team, but then I grew something that was successful, but I didn't love the outcome. And I see this a lot. And so one of the things we work on is who are you as an agent? And how do you build a business that when you get there, it suits you a lot better? And kind of there's sometimes where we prescribe some traditional methods, but there's a lot of times where we prescribe something that's very different because of that person. So that's on the agent side. On the W-2 side, it's really kind of helping people unpack their mindset. Like what is keeping them to the W-2? And we don't always just say like, get out of your job, right? It could be like, how do we build an investment strategy that leads people to a place where they can leave their job smoothly? But it's really understanding like, you know, what do you need financially? What do you need from a personality standpoint? Because in real estate, there are so many ways you can do it. So many ways, like different asset classes, different like some things that take a lot of your time, some things that take none of your time, whether it could be syndications or, you know, investing in funds, or it could be buying properties yourself or JVing. So depending on what somebody's goals are, who they are, can inform the strategy of how to get from A to B.
Mm-hmm. I love that. It's like a blueprint.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I love that because the people that want to leave typically, you know, and I'm speaking for myself, I want to see examples. You know, I want to hear someone who's achieved that or can at least point to the speed bumps, the potholes along the way. So when you work with those folks, like you said, there are times where maybe it's not the right move for them or maybe it's time. Like how do you determine, you know, what are some of the things that they would say to you where it's like, hey, maybe this isn't for you, or yeah, let's help you achieve this like tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great question. So essentially, like if someone has a very low risk tolerance, like they hate risk, throwing them into a very like all in risky type of situation is a really like, it's not a personality fit. And so oftentimes what I found is a lot of people who are low risk tolerance are generally also like, they're not the throw themselves into things really fast type of people, right? They generally are more analytical, like slow process analytical. And so as a result, like, let's say that's the case, I might introduce that person to something that is very passive, right? Maybe the returns are a lot lower, but just to kind of like, hey, you're actually investing in real estate now. You don't have to do anything, right? You're just putting some money in, but like you're investing in real estate while we start building the knowledge. Because people like me, I don't need to have a lot of knowledge on something to pursue it. Like I could just go and you throw me into something, blindfold me, I'm going to figure it out. But for other people, that would be like the end of them. And so it's really like, it's generally not like you shouldn't do real estate. It's more like, well, maybe you shouldn't go buy a 100-unit building on your first endeavor, right? Maybe you should, you know, go about it this way. So I assess someone's risk tolerance. I assess their personality and think, okay, you know, like for me, if you said, let's go really slow, let's start with something really light, I would be like, I don't want to work with you, right? Like you don't understand who I am. So I would say it's more about the strategy. Like everybody can invest in real estate and can become financially free there. But how is more of the differentiator.
Mm. And with W-2s, I'm sorry, with agents, how do you work with, I know you've told me some stories. I don't know if there's any stories you want to share in particular, because it might be very relatable for other agents I know who listen to this show. Any wins, any sort of ways that you could share how you work with agents?
Yeah, totally. So like, for example, one of the agents that I coach right now, starting next year, we're helping him launch an investing division of his company. So when he came to me, he was doing some decent volume as an agent. And then where we're taking him, we basically have almost helped him 50% increase in a few months where he's heading. So he's going to do like over 100 transactions this year. And so he's like, well, what do I do with this money? What do I do with all these things? And so it's like, well, hey, next step for you might be investing. And so he's really, really excited about that. So starting in January, he's going to be opening up that division of his business. So there'll be an element where, you know, he'll be obviously doing a lot of the work, but we might help become a partner in that business and help him bring all the capital, right? So there's like a lot of different things there. But just to give people wins, like it's just thinking about ideas maybe you would never have conceived. Like on the podcast, we had a guy who created 250K a year of annual net income off of a single real estate deal. He partnered with somebody where they bought a 40-acre property in New Mexico, right, of all places, and they created these, we'll call them villas, right, in New Mexico, like where people can get off the grid and stuff, and they rent them out. And so he partnered with somebody who was good at Airbnb, and he brought the money, and literally they create $250,000 in net income, right? Two retirement incomes, right? Most people, when you say, how much do you need to retire? It's 10K a month. It's two of them, one property. And so there's a one property method you can get to, right? If you buy the right property, you can be financially free, or there's the let's buy one rental at a time. So there's a lot of stories we could share after, you know, interviewing 450 people, a lot of ways to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely check out your podcast, right? So you'll hear more of those stories, folks, at the Freedom Chasers podcast. Brother, I want to get into a little bit more of your story in terms of things that you've experienced in the past that worked and didn't work through the segment called Embracing the F Word, meaning failure. So any lessons learned, any stories you could share where you fell flat on your face and you able to pick yourself back up and share with us, you know, what you learned from that?
Yeah, I mean, so many failures. So as far as like, I've taken business ideas and they've just been complete failures, right? Like, so for example, we developed software and we never launched that and sold that, right? So a lot of years, a decent amount of money, you know, completely wasted when it comes to a business scenario. So there's things like that. And so the learning that for me that came from it was there are certain things that I do incredibly well and that I actually do and I can do to completion. And I have more, we'll call it control from the standpoint that I can actually make sure that thing happens. And then there's things that are much, much more beyond me that require a lot more things to go right or a lot of other people. So I would say early on for me, it made a lot of sense to focus on things where I know, like I can get to the finish line, even if nobody else was there, and really get, aligned with my strength. Now, I do think long-term, you know, to grow a lot of businesses and have huge impact, someone has to learn how to be beyond themselves from, they need to know how to build businesses that they don't, you know, need to be involved in, but I would say early on in your wealth building journey, like doing what you can do well and you can control is really important. And kind of what Alex Ramosi hits on a lot is like not thinking you're smarter than you are. You know, I succeeded as a teacher. I succeeded as a salesperson. I succeeded as I got into real estate. And so I thought, dude, the world is my oyster. I know how to sell. I can make anything work. And you get ahead of your skis and then you start getting a lot of failures that you start racking up and realizing, nope. Like I can't do everything. I shouldn't do everything. So
in the software company, could you share something that you are really clear on in terms of like, okay, I can't control that, or you tried to control everything. And then, some of the pieces, like what were some of the pieces that were missing that you figured out? Oh, okay. If I had trusted in someone to do that, then maybe it would have worked.
So there was a number of things. I mean, first of all, we were way too feature rich, right? So what I recognized, like, so we built a million features and they worked well for our business. But, so what ended up suffering was a lot of like the design and those other components that are so necessary in software. And what's interesting too is like, while people want a lot of features, it has to be super intuitive, right? There has to be a process for them to grab onto those. So, We built with some overseas programmers as well, you know, which in retrospect, I think if I had formed some better partnerships in the US and had them as heads of development, that would have been a lot different. So there was some code stuff that I think would have made scale a little bit challenging. And what's interesting too is like how fast software moves. So when I started building, what I wanted was not even close to existing. There were real estate CRMs, but there was nothing like what we were building. Well, in the 3 or 4 year process it took us to build, a lot of things caught up, right? Not exactly to what we had, but they caught up. And so now all of a sudden it's like, well, me with my small team is building this. And then this team over here that has millions and millions and millions of dollars, right, is building this. Like, this would be a really, it's like me fighting a 350-pound dude. It's like, yeah, I can get in the ring, but this is probably not going to be very fun. And it may not go well. So at that point it was like, okay, I feel like I'm running an uphill battle.
Yeah. I kind of feel and relate to that, you know, in the podcast space. You know, we started our podcast agency in 2018. There were not many as there are now. And the ones that did it right, have like far exceeded, you know, what we're doing. I'm friends with a lot of them, you know, maybe even 10x, what we produce, and systems, processes, and capital, bro. Capital. Like, they were able to invest in, like you said, you know, whatever it is they needed, mainly software, you know, user experience, things like that, where that wasn't our focus. You know, it was all relationship based. But yeah, I get that. Yeah. How long did you invest time and money into that?
So I think it was about 3 or 4 years or so. Now, what I will say is a lot of it was mutually valuable from the standpoint that when you build a software, you work out, especially if you build it for you, you work out all your systems and processes in a way that you never would if you didn't build software. And so when we decided to shut it down, I knew exactly what software we wanted to go to, and I knew exactly how we wanted to run our business. So it made the transition very, very smooth. So I wouldn't say it was all time wasted, but about 3 or 4 years. I would say the multiple six figures we threw at it is probably the harder part to swallow.
Yeah, yeah. I know software is a very sort of blue ocean opportunity type of space. But then, like you said, it moves so fast. You got to be able to pivot. I can't even imagine if you develop something and then like you turn around and then it's becoming obsolete. You're like, oh crap. Yeah, brother. So good. I love that story. I don't think we've talked about that one. So thanks for sharing. Let's jump a little bit into sort of what you're doing now. What is the future for Matt Cavanaugh, his coaching business, the podcast, all that good stuff?
Yeah. So for me, you know, going through the cycle from being a teacher, barely making ends meet, to being a real estate investor and agent, where, you know, money is a lot different now than it was then. I've had the ability to have the freedom to kind of figure out, how do I want to position my life? How do I want to do things? And so it's really been a quest for a return of energy and doing things where I can provide really, really high value. So right now, like I coach agents, you know, generally one-on-one to help them, because it's where I get a lot of satisfaction. I feel like I can make the biggest difference. And it's like, anytime I'm sitting in a one-to-one conversation, whether it be on a podcast, a sales call, or coaching, like I feel like I'm at my highest level of joy and value. And so that's generally how I'm structuring my days, is whether it's helping people through podcasts or coaching calls or even ultra high ticket sales.
Yeah. So out of all those three things, yeah, which in order do you love the most? Put you on the spot.
Oh yeah. So it depends on some context. So like, for example, closing an ultra high ticket sale is really fun. The idea, like, we close close sales for people that are $50,000, $100,000. So to meet somebody on a phone call and to have them ready to buy a $100,000 scenario 30 minutes later is like it's a big rush. So like that's fun, but like there's a purpose and a meaning that happens on a lot of podcast episodes when you get to deeply know somebody. And then with coaching, it's really like solving a problem that really helps somebody's life. So I would say, like, oh gosh, I wouldn't want to go without any of them. Like, I would want all of them. If I need an energy spike, it's ultra high ticket sales. If I need to feel like really great about life, it's probably coaching or podcast.
It's like having a 3-car garage. You know, you got a Ferrari in one, Jeep in the other, you know, maybe a boat in the other. I don't even know the third one, but maybe a Tesla. Yeah, yeah. It's like, okay, depending on my mood, I'll jump in one of these, but they're all great.
Well, it was exactly right, right? I mean, sometimes you want to get in a car and go really fast. And sometimes you want to put the top down and just drive slow along the coast.
Yeah, that's 100%. Good. That's good, brother. Well, dude, I appreciate this time, man. It's always fun. It's always eye-opening. You know, I'm happy to have heard and discovered some new things, you know, always looking to explore and find new ways that you can help and how we can align. So in one word, brother, How do you help people?
I help them by unpacking their situation. I think a lot of people, they don't know what they don't know. And so, for example, when we get down in the questions with them, we ask very different questions than what is standard. And so we discover things that can help them create a business and a life that's better than they thought possible. Because we can use a different strategy, or we can align strategy with who they are much closer. And so I would say, like, what we do is we help people build businesses that they, that they love.
So the one word I heard there is unpack or unpacking. So helping people do that. I will say this. This is a little hidden gem for those of you who stuck in till the end. You're also a little bit of a Cupid. You know, you also help people in terms of just connecting people, and maybe something flourishes out of that. So, I appreciate you, brother, for spending time and sharing some of the things that you've learned, and also how you help people. So, yeah, brother, always good.
All right. Thanks, man.